Good to be with you here this morning. If you're new here, I'd love to meet you and get to know your name. So feel free and don't feel shy to come and say hi afterwards. We're in the beginning of a new season. We're also in the beginning of a new series, and we're calling it Why Church? So I actually want to start by just asking that question. Why are you here? Why am I here? Why church? You have that question sometimes? Is it maybe even in your mind right now as you sit here? I think during COVID, some of us really got used to sleeping in on Sundays. I definitely did. I got used to not volunteering for things. It was really nice. I was telling someone last night that no Sunday church meant that we had time to install blinds in our living room after living there for 7 years, and that was really great. So I wonder why we wrangle our kids to get to the Japanese hall at 10:30 each week. And I wonder why we set our alarms for 9 a.m. after a fun Saturday night. And why we gather in this big room with a bunch of friends and strangers to sing with the AC broken and say words together and then listen to someone talk. So why church? And at a bigger level, why church? Is church a meaningful institution anymore? I think I've heard that question voiced aloud in our group discussions in this room, so I know at least some of us are holding that question. We could potentially follow Jesus in a more private and individual way, and sometimes there are seasons for that. But why do we follow Jesus alongside others? What are we here seeking? At staff retreat this past year, we went away and we asked ourselves the same question. We asked, why do they still come to artisan gatherings? Why do we still come? Sundays or midweek groups, right? It's all church. And we started brainstorming answers, not why we should, but why we do. What do we hear about this? And we drew on our conversations with many of you, our own motivations for being here. And by the end of one day, we had narrowed it down to three categories. These are three words. Now, they probably don't capture everything, and we even wondered in the moment if they were accurate and complete. But as we've sat with them over the summer, they felt, at least for me, increasingly true for us and for our community. So let's try these on. The three words are healing, community, and imagination. Why do we come to church? Because we need regular, holistic, interpersonal healing. Because we need belonging in a community of solidarity. And because we need fresh imagination for what the world could be like, what we could be like, what the future could be. So we gather to engage in these three spiritual practices. And lest you think, but isn't it simpler than that? Isn't it just about Jesus? Yeah, of course it is. Of course it is. And Jesus is concerned with the renewal of all things. So what does renewal look like, and what needs renewing? And that's where these three words come in. Jesus was a healer, Jesus created community in surprising places, and Jesus helped people imagine the world differently. So life, death, resurrection of Jesus is at the heart of all three of these practices too. So in order to explore these three practices at Artisan this year, we're gonna do two things. First, now in September, this week and the following 2 weeks, we're going to explore each week one of these practices. Today is healing at the Pool of Bethesda in John 5. Next week, we'll look at community. Following week, imagination. And then the second thing we're going to do is throughout the whole year, we're going to have series that kind of dig deeper into an aspect of one of these practices. So today, we look at healing. And we're going to first do it by looking at a true story about Jesus, the healer. And then second, about talking about healing at Artisan, which is where I start to tremble a little bit, but we'll get there. Okay, let's start with our story. So one day, Jesus travels to Jerusalem for a religious festival. At this time, Jerusalem was a walled city, and it had gates in it. And one of the gates was called the Sheep Gate. And it was called that because this is the gate where sacrificial animals were brought in from the fields in order to be taken to the temple for religious rituals. And near the gate was a pool. It was called Bethesda. And that pool was connected to an underground spring. It also collected rainwater. And around the four sides of this pool were covered walkways, sort of. And then there was a fifth one right through the middle, across the pool, that kind of separated it into two pools. If you can picture that with me. And this pool has religious significance. People come here for ritual purification. It's thought to be sacred water. A different group comes here too for a different reason. People who don't have a recognized function in society. At night, they're shooed out through the gate to sleep in the fields. And then in the morning, they come back in to the city and they find their place along the side of this pool under a walkway. It's a good place to solicit generosity because there's religious people around. It's a good place also to find solidarity with other people who don't have acceptable work or who can't work or can't see or can't walk. So this story happens on Sabbath, the rest day. It's a day for rest, religious rituals, and Jesus is on the walkways. He's engaging community as they lounge in rejection and expendability. One of the people who hangs out here has been unable to walk for nearly four decades. He's genuinely a neighborhood fixture. Someone said to me this week, a gargoyle in the Cathedral of Life. You're just always there. And Jesus walks by him, notices him, and perhaps even gets targeted for money by him. And Jesus knows, or maybe as he notices the man, someone whispers to him, this man has been here a long time. This expendability, this scrounging, this is his life. Never mind him. He's always here, and he always will be. Instead of giving a handout to a beggar, as many people do in this area that's well known for begging, Jesus speaks to him and asks an unexpected question. Do you want to get well? Someone else pointed out to me this week, it's a corrective emotional experience to be invited into an honest conversation, even if it's challenging, rather than being ignored or pitied. But do you want to get well? That's a really confronting question, especially to ask of someone like this here at the pool. Potential misunderstanding, potential offense. It's also really unexpected curiosity that's what he's curious about. An invitation to connect at that level of desire and potential transformation. Do you want to be unfrozen? Do you want to be melted into flesh so that you can start moving and healing after all these years? It's honest, it's pragmatic. Imagine decades of lying around near the pool, making a living by engaging charity, the paralysis of wounds. What would it mean to not be here doing this anymore? How would it be to re-enter the workforce, to be friends with well people, to not receive generosity, and to make a different kind of life altogether than the one you know? Healing is change. Healing is uncomfortable. And healing won't happen in an instant. It will take time to regain that life. So, do you want to get well? And the man responds with deference. He says, sir, or master, he calls Jesus, I have no one. So the question, do you want to get well? And the answer, I have no one. They seem incongruous to me. Do you want to get well? I have no one. Someone commented this week that the cry, I have no one, is much deeper despair than I can't walk. I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. I'm trying to get in. Someone else goes down ahead of me. He starts communicating his desperation. And as an aside, when I read this, I think this is a survivor's answer. And I may not look like a survivor, but I resonate with his survivor communication here. He wants to drive home his absolute need. And if it's even a little bit true that he literally has no one, then his need is absolute. How do you survive without UGM dinners or public health care or disability payments? How do you survive in a communal culture with literally no connections? How do we even do it with those things? Could sound like an excuse, but it's also really powerful communication and rhetoric. It's a survivor's rhetoric. He wants Jesus to understand the complete lack of agency that he feels. He wants this person who seems interested in his condition to feel responsible, and he wants to draw Jesus into his network of support, like my survivor friend who would tell me every year when we would organize her annual birthday party that this was, she had never had someone throw her birthday party before. And within her landscape, she was speaking truth because she needed me to know how essential this party was to her well-being. And that was the strongest way she could put it. "You seem to care that I'm ill, the man says to Jesus, "so take responsibility. I have no one." And Jesus responds, "Get up, pick up your mat, walk." He doesn't address what could have sounded like excuses that he was being given. He doesn't address even what might have been exaggerations. And he doesn't insist on the man saying that he wants to be well. You know, there's no, okay, but if you're going to heal, you're going to have to really want it. You're going to have to be really disciplined to follow through. Da, 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 da. He lets that go. He lets it go. Apparently, Jesus' healing can arrive sometimes completely as grace. And Jesus knows how to move him into the next stage of healing. He overcomes these problems of agency, support, even willpower and hope. Jesus, the healer, notices the pain, asks the question of curiosity, gives the gift that's needed, and then disappears. Then later, the man gets stopped by some self-appointed community police. "You shouldn't be carrying your mat around on the Sabbath." Actually understandable and right. This is a formerly enslaved group of people. They instituted Sabbath as a matter of justice. We are no longer slaves. We have escaped Egypt. Remember that? The Hebrews escaping slavery in Egypt. And then we were given the Ten Commandments. We do not work 24/7 anymore. We are not slaves. Why are you walking around acting like this? But what was liberating for one people group at one point in time is not always liberating for another community or person. And so I think this is an important thing to remember for those of us seeking to follow Jesus in healing work. What is liberating for some of us in this room is not liberating for others of us in that room, in this room. And that makes me tremble a little bit. But asking what is desired, as Jesus did, that's an important first step. So for this man, liberation is picking up his mat and walking, Sabbath or not. So he says to the community police, "The guy who healed me told me to do it," and we don't really question healers, right? I don't think you want to either, but they want to know, well, who is this? So later the man finds out who Jesus is and goes back and tells them. Now, as a kid, I would always groan at this point in the story. I would say, "Don't tell Jesus' enemies who he is. Don't you know you're going to get him killed?" So we always know the end of the story. But actually, the actions of the man really make sense if we're thinking about healing here. Those of you who were around last fall may remember there was a sermon that I preached on the woman who bled for 12 years and Jesus' healing of that woman. And one of the things that came out of that sermon for me was the difference between healing and cure. Ultimately, as mortal human beings, our lives won't likely include permanent cures, this side of resurrection. But holistic healing, that can happen, even in the face of a terminal illness or chronic pain. So healing is about restoring meaning to your life so you can walk. Oh, right, now go restore relationship with the people who determine whether you belong in society and give you a job or not. I'm curious what might have happened if instead of going to tell them, he had linked his belonging with Jesus' new way instead of the same old structures of social power. But who knows what happened after the story. So what invitation do you hear in this story for yourself? For me, this story is an invitation to honestly answer the question, do I want to heal? Do I want my heart to be melted so I can move again? Or do I prefer to stay frozen? And it's a real question, it's not facetious. I have specific situations in mind as I say that. I think it also invites us to be a survivor in God's presence, to pray like a survivor, to offer our desperation, our exaggeration, self-indulgence, rhetorical flourishes, anger, frustration, longing, to offer all of that to Jesus and then wait to see what the Spirit will do. I remember a really intractable conflict a number of years ago that I was in. I was so angry. And I remember one day walking across a field. It was near my house, so I walk across it daily to get to work. Looking at the dandelions, you know how you mull, have arguments with people in your head. I was doing that. And as I walked, I felt the bitterness against a particular person just go. It just dissolved. And there was nothing in my arguing with that person that could have created that. It was a moment of complete grace, something I wasn't able to accomplish on my own. Like Jesus' offer of healing without requiring something of this man. But there were still things in that situation that I was mulling over that couldn't be healed just walking across the field by myself. Some of it had to be healed a year later when a group of women got in a circle together and we grieved together what had happened. And then some more stuff still needed to be healed. And some of that happened in coming to Artisan a year and a bit ago. So that's where I want to go next. Just the significance of healing in community and specifically at Artisan. What about healing at Artisan? I think I wouldn't dare broach this subject except that so many people have talked about healing to me in this community. So I feel somewhat confident in being able to relay it as something that I've heard. So many people talk about healing in this community that it's really clear that a lot of us have been drawn to this particular church because we need healing or we want to participate in healing. There's the healing of family relationships, healing our theology, healing social divides, healing our relationship to our bodies, whether they're ill or well, healing our religious trauma, and so on. And that's striking to me that we still feel drawn to gather around Jesus. It's like I've been reading this book on wound healing, and it's a little bit like healing a wound. You have kind of this initial destruction of a biological structure, maybe the vein, or, you know, nurses in the room are going to be horrified the way I describe this, but the destruction of a biological structure. And then new pathways need to be built for the same life force to flow through, right? Similarly, we need new structures for the life force of Jesus to flow through us. So some of us have found that here, and some of us are wondering if we'll find it here or not. And some of us are impatient. The structures aren't different enough. But we still feel drawn to gather around Jesus here. And I think it's because we've been created to heal both alone and together. Healing's both individual responsibility and also shared work. And this is what I want to say. There's two things I want to say. Healing is shared work, and healing is shared work. Both of those things. That's all I really want to say in the next couple of minutes about Artisan. I think, when I think about Vancouver specifically, and it's probably other places as well, but just let's stick with ourselves, many of us have turned our need for healing into what I would call an individual pathology. I don't know if you know what I mean by that. Like, in other words, the responsibility to heal, even though I've been hurt by lots of structures and the way we are together, the responsibility to heal is on me because I'm the wounded one or the ill person, so I just hope to God that I have health benefits. I expend whatever resources I have. I surround myself with healing professionals. I read the books that will help me figure this out. I pursue a healing path in private. And I don't want to underestimate taking responsibility for our own healing, not by a long shot. You know, that's sacred work. And a counselor said to me this week, actually emailed, said this individual work is like a petri dish for engaging the rest of life, resourcing us to be more tolerant with discomfort when we leave the counselor's room or when we leave the doctor's room. So Jesus says to us in Vancouver, do you want to be well? And many of us say, yes, desperately, I'll get to work on that. Healing happens there on an individual level. But what I've learned from Diane Milligan, she's an Indigenous professor at the University of Washington, and also what I see in Jesus' stories is that healing is also profoundly shared work. If you remember the man's answer, I have no one, that's his answer to whether or not he wanted to be well. So much of what we're wounded by is our relationships with other people. So many of our wounds happen in communities and within their structures. And so much of the pain of our illnesses is actually about our disconnection that happens from other people. Emotional hurt can actually turn into trauma or not based on whether or not we perceive we're alone with it, whether we're undefended or not. So as we're drawn into this space close to the healer, I think we're invited to take risks of connection. This maybe also is a bit of a petri dish of prayer, of conversation, of conflict and repair. And we do this good work not just for ourselves, but for the broader communities that we scatter to when we leave here. For me, I can hardly hope for a situation like Palestine and Israel if I can't first find healing for my anger with the person who unknowingly verbally offended me last Sunday. There wasn't actually someone. We were at the park. It's okay. Just an example. I'm reading a book right now by two women in medical fields, and it's called Designed to Heal, What the Body Shows Us About Healing Wounds, Repairing Relationships, Restoring Community. And the premise is best described with this quote, due to the amazing design of our bodies, our injuries don't have to be the last word. Repair, restoration, even regeneration are built into our very cells. And then later, what if our corporate bodies, i.e. our communities, were oriented to healing the way our physical bodies are? Or to put it differently, what if the church was known for its willingness to do the hard work of healing? What if that was our witness? The hard work of healing, what we have caused as well as what we have received. I have more to say, but if there's one thing you take away from today, let it be that curiosity. What if the witness of Jesus' followers could be our willingness to work toward repair internally and with others? I think it's a vision that nestles really close at Jesus' side. Jesus the healer, supporting people in the hard work of transformation, grieving death, celebrating healing, and also carrying this larger vision for the painful, slow work of global transformation. I've got one caveat, though, but and it's a big one. This requires trust. And some of you have already been thinking it and arguing with me in your head, I bet. Connecting with a community is risky, more so for some of us than others. Other of us may not relate to this at all. But if you've experienced religious trauma in a church, how do you know that the exact same structures aren't in this new one, right? So then here's my question for you, and I don't know the answer exactly, but what are the markers of a community that continues Jesus' healing work? Because those are the markers we want to take on and have to figure out together. What are the markers of a community that continues Jesus' healing work? Let me offer just a few thoughts from my own thinking this week and over the past couple months, and take it as you will, and hopefully you also have more to add. I'm gonna invite you at the end to actually add some of these answers up on these brown paper signs that say healing on them during and after communion. So these are some thoughts for me to start us off. First and foremost, I think those of us in leadership need to explicitly separate our words and actions from God's. I think I had a bad word in here because I felt so strongly about this that we're fully human, and that's all that the church can promise, right? We can't promise more than being human. As leaders, we can't promise more than being human. But we gather around Jesus, and that's what we can all hope in together, right? So I think explicitly separating the church sort of structure from Jesus is super important for many of us in healing. And second, recognizing that we're all wounded up in here. We're all wounded up in here, and that there are better and worse ways of us creating a healing community. One of the ways that I found really helpful is thinking in terms of trauma-informed ministry. So psychologist Stephen Portis, who has studied this, says that safety is the treatment in terms of healing, And we know here at Artisan that it's not advisable for healing. It's even impossible to try and create a completely safe environment for everyone where there are no risks, right? We can't do that. We don't want to do that. But we can strive to be safe enough for one another and create ways of communicating that allow us to feel unsafe and stay connected. So safety, he would say, and these are trauma-informed practices, are produced through trustworthiness, the offer of choice, a collaborative environment, and empowerment. And honestly, I see all of those in Jesus when I look at Jesus' interactions with people who need healing. So how do we do that here in this church? I think we've got a long way to go, but we're thinking about it. I want to offer you three opportunities, just to be real practical, three opportunities that I think might be a place for you to work out. If healing is one of the pieces that you're here mostly for, here are a few. Next week, we'll talk about community, but if healing is what you're here for, these may be ways for you to move forward. The first is group spiritual direction, which Nelson offered a description of earlier. It's a small, like just a few people, safe container for vulnerability and connection. So it's been crafted really diligently, carefully by Nelson over the years, and it's been a source of a lot of healing for people. So if you're in a season where you need your faith journey to be held with care and in confidence by a few others, that might be the avenue for you. Another possibility, trauma-informed prayer training. So our prayer team participated in a training last fall, and we had subsequent dialogue just to create best practices for our prayer corner, which is where we offer prayer for folks during communion. I'm going to share some of that work as part of a discussion of trauma-informed prayer in October. So if you're wondering, what does that look for a particular church ministry to try to be healing, that might be an avenue for you. And the third one is, starting in October, for 7 consecutive Wednesdays, we're going to be hosting the course. It's called The Body of Christ Keeps the Score. And it's going to be a pop-up neighborhood group. Anybody can join, probably here, but potentially in someone's home. And this course is narrating the history of the Western Church through the lens of trauma. And then we'll have a final session that invites us into dialogue about how we foster a healthier communal future. So if you're struggling particularly with the history of the church, then this might be an avenue for working through that with others. So each of these is not for everyone. It's just, is one of these feel like, yeah, that's the next step that I could take? Okay, why church? Because we need healing? Because we need a place to celebrate healing? Because we need a place to hear hopeful stories about healing? Because we need to be able to turn our healing into praise and collective transformation? Because we know it's not just about us. We need healing. But interestingly, and this is the last thing I'm going to say, this event in John 5 was not recorded to answer the question, why church, as you can imagine. That wasn't their question at the time. They might not have even had that word at the time. The question was, who is Jesus? That was the question. And every story that John has of healing, there's three of them, they end with this. See who Jesus is. If you keep reading in the narrative, you'll see that there's this sort of like dialogue, sort of disagreement about who Jesus is. What offends the people who are offended by Jesus so much right after this story is not the healing, but it's that he claims kinship with God. And he says, my Father's always at work, so I too am working on the Sabbath. So Jesus claims the very honor of God. I think we're here to wait expectantly for the grace to change and move and soften into flesh, both as individuals and as the Western Church. And I think we do that through coming to Jesus. Would you pray with me before we go to the table together? Jesus, may the individual and collective healing that we experience become an ongoing witness to the presence of your dwelling here with us.